value our fishing industry for a lot of reasons. It's romantic, even noble. It takes great skill, it builds character, and it's a huge employer. But one attribute we may not value enough is it tastes good. Unique, even. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Just think what we would lose if our unique local fisheries were pushed out by other industries or industrialized themselves. Phone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. It's slow fish, the subject today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Slow fish. If you're a fisherman, you gotta like slow fish, right? They're easier to catch. That's a joke. As you probably know, slow fish is part of the slow food movement. And we happen to have someone from the slow food movement here who is running the slow fish campaign. And she just happens to be in Alaska while the Fish Council is meeting. And when I found out about it, I invited her to come. And she said yes. So here she is, Michelle Mesmin. Welcome.
Hello, Steve. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So you, for people that don't know anything about slow food, of which there will be a number, many, although we have discussed it here and we've talked about like food security and diversity and things like that. And every once in a while we talk about the taste aspect of things as well. But this slow food movement has been, it was mostly European-centered, but it's now gone all around the world. And it's essentially the idea of one chef in Italy who you live not far from, yes?
Yes, actually, I was born more than 20 years ago now. It was really a reaction to fast food growing everywhere. And people in Italy, they're so proud of their food from one village to the other. They fight over recipes and who has the best products and they're really experts in their own regional food, so they could see it coming much better than French people did, for example, who have a more unified cuisine, and in which country the changes were more gradual, probably. In Italy, it just hit them very frontally, and for them, food is everything. It's quality of life. It's their identity. It's so important. So they decide to react, and to react from how they do. It's this usually never through institutional frames. It's just the civil society organizing creatively. So they started spreading the message and saying, okay, let's do little regional groups and each one of them focus on some of your food that you think is important for you. And so they started basically promoting their recipes, their products, and then they realized, oh my God, if we are promoting the products, well, we have to promote the producers because without them, we won't have the product. So we're not only losing taste, we're losing everything behind from people, our neighbors, livelihoods, knowledge, landscapes. And so that's how slow food started and is now in 150 countries.
Yeah, I'm suddenly remembering the last time that we discussed slow food. I told about my grandfather who was German and a butcher and made sausage, and that he would never tell my uncle the recipe for the sausage. And he died. And my uncle never did get the recipe. And I said, so if anybody has, you know, so this is something that come down through the family that gets lost. And I'll be darned, somebody actually called up and said, look, you know, I've got our family recipe, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's the same. And I don't really know. But family is tied into this too. That's my point.
Family is tied out. Is tied in there. Communities are. I mean, it's really, It's the bond also of trust between people. That's kind of the scale we're talking about.
Tell me more. The bond of trust between people.
Yes. I mean, if you look at today, I mean, everybody's kind of scared of what they're eating because we've lost the bond of trust. And I think it's kind of we've lost the relationships among ourselves, but also among a community with your food producers, which is supposedly the primary economy. And now who knows their farmer? Who knows? I think you're in Alaska. I think many of you are still very lucky because you know your fishermen.
Yeah.
But where I'm working in most places, nobody knows, has any clue.
Right. Well, I was thinking about one, the slow fish movement has this thing that we'll talk about shortly called Presidia, or the Presidium that they set up surrounding a particular fishery where everybody kind of bands together. And I want to get into that subject, but I think, what do we have in Alaska that's close to that? And what I came up with was the Norton Sound Red King Crab fishery, which the outside crabbers decided not to take an interest in for various reasons. And so it's just the locals who fish the crab and sell them off the docks. And it's like, they would tell you, and I would agree, that's the best crab in the world.
Well, so, you're right. I mean, there's many dimensions to that. So how they fish it is also important. But definitely, I mean, if it's endangered, if it's these other products that are endangering these fisheries, then it could be considered as a
procedure. Do you think it's true that there's a stewardship relationship? If a fishery gets local enough, in other words, you would think there would be a vested interest in conservation, because otherwise you lose the you lose the commodity. But I think kind of the economic theory of the prevailing economic theory of fisheries these days is not that. The prevailing theory is that the fishermen would happily fish the last fish out of the ocean because they get a great price for it. In other words, it's an image of selfishness. And fishermen will be the first to tell you that they do compete. But have you seen in all your experience of running slow fish now, have you seen examples where fishermen actually do take a stewardship interest in that which provides that which they sell?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've seen many, but it's hard for them. And those who manage to continue to nurture that attitude are usually those who are collectively managing their resource. Like, it's very hard for individuals to do that, although some manage to do it anyways. But these have to be, like, really exceptional. They have to be not only good fishermen, they have to be also good business people, or at least, creative enough to work on the value chain, not only on the fish. And not every fisherman is capable of doing that. But I've seen a lot of this, and I see it also, like, in elder fishermen. I think many fishermen have been pushed out of this stewardship at least in Europe, where basically after the war, there was huge subsidies given to have bigger boats, fish more.
Right. And the older generation, well, this is the way it's done now. And, you know, if my son, my daughter is going to compete in this world, they need to do it this new way.
Yes, I mean, from one side, they have a dwindling resource and this competition from, like, big boats that are just catching all this volume of fish without really paying the cost of the externalities of the destruction of some of the ecosystem, including nurseries, I mean. And also then they're in this free market with a lot of exports products. I mean, the shrimps from Ecuador come in at a ridiculous price. And you know why they come in at that ridiculous price? Because they're actually raised illegally. So you have illegal product that comes into our market, is competing, crushing the price, pushing the prices down. Then you have a market that is concentrating the value on a very few species instead of, like, trying to you put the value on all of the product of a particular ecosystem. So what can they do? I mean, it takes, you have to be a hero to fight that kind of crushing logic and
mechanism.
But
we do have these heroes.
Yes, I think you do. And I find these heroes everywhere. There's a fantastic example in the Mediterranean, and the Mediterranean is a really tough one too. Well, it's different than here because it's warm water, so you have lots of, it's a really a multi-species fisheries, I mean, even more than anywhere else. There's this institution in France called Prud'homie. They've been around for 10 centuries. So what they did is they divided the French coast, the whole French coast, in 33 corridors. Well, two of them are in Corsica. And each fishing communities manages that corridor. And how they do it is, first of all, their philosophy is everyone must be able to live from their fishing art. So the one that the smallest are always privileged over the larger ones. So once you make sure that even the smallest one can live from it, then you go from there. The other way they did it, like to make sure the resource will still be there for the next generation, is, well, you have a limit on what you can catch on one particular species. You want to catch more, fine, but then you have to develop other arts. So all of these fisher are actually not, it's against like the current trend of specialization. Now you're kind of like doing just one fisheries for which you need the license, the gear, the quota, whatever, and then it's impossible to pass from one species to
really,
the other.
You're really into all the macroeconomics of this, aren't you?
Well, it's part of the picture. I mean, if you want to understand it.
Well, you started out in business school, you were telling me.
Yes, not my favorite part of my education, but
right. Well,
but
these concepts of like value added, for instance, which we're always struggling with in Alaska. Because it's thought of as raw resources. So the minute you have some manufacturing, you have more jobs and so forth. And this can be fish processing or whatever. So it used to be the canneries would just come in and gobble up all the fish and put them in cans. And they needed labor for a very short period of time. And then the labor either was unemployed or left. And they just came in and did the fish slime lines and left. And now there's much more concept of preserving the quality of the catch and having looking for value added. I mean, there's all kinds of smoking going on, all kinds of processing going on that didn't used to happen.
Yes, and when we talk about value, it's not only the monetary value. It's also the social and cultural value of a fishery. I mean...
Well, that's your message, isn't it?
Yes, and we have the same attitude to all our foods, because that's the way to have happy neighbors around you instead of having more unemployed people in the big cities, isn't it?
So that's the part that doesn't fit into the macroeconomic theory.
Yes, it is. What about the gifts? I mean, all these people trading services.
Okay, well, here's one for you. I have a friend from Nelson Island, and some friends came in, and he lives in Anchorage, and they came in from Nelson Island, and they brought some indigenous food. And one of them was these, I'd never seen, was Nelson Island's out near the Bering Sea. You would think it was part of the mainland, but it's actually an island. And there's been no real reason for colonial forces to penetrate very quickly there. And so some of the indigenous cultures really, really dug in and hung on. And it's pretty tough to live out there. And they brought in these, they were sticks. They were just sticks, but they were covered with herring roe. And he gave them to me, and he said, "Well, you might want to put some salt on this." he said, "Because it doesn't have much flavor right now, you know." He says, "I would dip it in seal oil, but maybe salt." And so, yeah, he was right. Actually, it did need some salt or soy sauce or something like that. But I was thinking, this is so far from a product. And yet so valuable to this person. And what you're talking about in terms of slow fish is somewhere in between there. In other words, I think a lot of Alaskans have these subsistence activities and they enjoy and treasure them and share them personally, but it does never get into any kind of economic sphere at all. And maybe sometimes you have to think about, well, okay, how about if we spread it out a little more? Maybe it would have an economic mass to it.
Well, the thing is, if we work a lot with these subsistence products, but usually there's so much at risk because you get one generation down the line that starts eating fast food and is not interested in doing it, and you lose the whole culture and you lose the whole knowledge of it. So if you don't have some mechanism that gives value, whether it is a cultural value or an economic, and usually it kind of goes a little bit together, well, then, you know, you risk losing that culture. So, but you can do small scales. I mean, you can find value chains that adapt to that particular scale. And part of it is just working a little bit on the local market. I mean, many of our fishers, they do subsistence fisheries, but maybe they put this little eatery and they just have like a surplus income, right? Which is like one job. And so the tourists come and they taste the local food. So they have also a better understanding of this area and of the resources and the people and their people's activity. Because, I mean, you can really taste a region through its products. And that kind of part is part of building the memory of that particular area.
We're talking to Michelle Mismath. She is the Slow Fish Campaign Director of Slow Food International. She's from Italy, and but she's here in Alaska at the moment. You're not in particular out here evangelizing or anything like that. But nonetheless, what I'd like to invite our listeners to do is suggest potential Alaska slow fish possibilities that might be something that other people will really enjoy to eat that could be developed in the, I don't want to say product exactly, but just a wider sharing perhaps. And so that brings me around to this Presidium idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things actually. I mean, Slow Food created this foundation for biodiversity. And the first project was the Ark of Taste. Let's not lose taste, because we realized there was like 500 artisanal products lost every year. And that was just Italy alone. So we cannot lose that. And the first step to not losing is identifying these products and putting them on this arc for us, where it's like highlighted as something that has value. The second step are the Presidia project, which is like some of these projects, we couldn't do it with all of the products, with, but where the conditions are right, we'll say, okay, here we have 10 producers. What can we do to allow them to secure this job, this knowledge, this culture over time? What do we have to do? For some of them, it's inviting them to the international food events we do. There's this Terra Madre and Salone del Gusto in October every 2 years, and it's coming up next year, 60,000 square meters of exhibition of regional, delicious, unique products.
Al gusto.
Al gusto. Salone del gusto. So, you know, I could see, for example, Herring Row going to Salone del Gusto and have like all the food journalists come in and say, oh, what's this? And become curious. And sometimes just that sparks the interest locally. Just having this interest of foreign press. I mean, unfortunately or fortunately, it works sometimes this way.
So if it was a situation where, you know, that the elders are worried that the young people don't know how to get bidarkies off of the rocks anymore, they could form some kind of alliance.
Yes.
In whatever form it might be, that people would pass on this knowledge in whatever framework was necessary, through a community hall, through some kind of games.
Exhibitions, you know, through education
activities. The Bidarkie Festival, it could be anything.
Absolutely.
I see. Well, our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. So a presidium could be small.
It can be very small.
Yeah. It's a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is an option, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're talking slow fish, an idea whose time has come in Alaska, with Michelle Mismath of the Slow Fish Campaign. And let's go to Bob in Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Good morning. Well, I had an older brother that was involved in seafood business. It was called Silver Lining a long time ago. And I have a poster he gave me. It says Silver Lining on it, but it was done by Mr. Troll. And it's got all the fish, all the bottom fish that they fished. Most of them I'd never heard of before. And a lot of them have become delicacies. I don't know if I have anything new to add. I grew up in the interior. We used to subsistence fish down in Valdez, and my father made smoked salmon and claw candy. And something I would never eat till I got older was pickled salmon. And that's kind of a slow process, I guess. But you know, what you were saying about lost recipes, I lost that with my father.
Mm.
Like lost a lot of those recipes. You know, we had a little store outside of Fairbanks, and he made sausage and stuff. And when I was just a baby, he was urged, I think, by Bob Bartlett to go up to Barrow and build their first certified slaughterhouse for reindeer, and started using the meat for sausage. I don't know if it was done commercially. I think that was probably the first time that was actually started being done commercially in Alaska. But there are so many bottom fish out there that I'd never heard of on this poster. The sable fish is one. I've heard of sable fish, but I've never tasted it. But I guess it's quite a delicacy.
Oh, are you kidding? Yeah, it's also, because it's so fatty, it's one of those that keeps really well. We were just talking about that last night. Black cod's one of your best fish for smoking.
Yeah.
It's called black cod now.
Oh, is it called black cod?
Yeah, yeah. That's what they do, I believe the slime head is now called orange ruffy.
Orange ruffy. Yeah. When I was a little kid, we used to be able to catch a lot of those fish right off the small harbor boat dock in Valdez, but I doubt if you can do that now.
Yeah.
It sounds like an interesting concept, slow fish. You know, well, as everybody knows, we've had quite the controversy here in Cook Inlet regarding sport fishing and commercial fishing and who is supposed to get the first dibs on it and the cutback of being able to catch the king salmon. Anyway, we'll just have to see how that works out.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough one.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for your program, and it's a very interesting concept of a slow fish. I wish I had my dad's old recipes, and I've tried to duplicate some of them, but I haven't had much luck with it.
Well, if you have a nice recipe, please send it to me on the site, slowfish@slowfood.com, and we can publish it, because we're looking for local recipes with local sustainable fish. And
yeah,
you know,
well, I do have a recipe for pickled salmon, and it's quite an involved process to do it right. You know, it has to be washed and salted and then brined and then placed in the final solution.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at it looked like just raw fish. I wouldn't eat it when I was young. One time I came home and I had the munchies, and I opened up the jar that Dad had made, and I ate the whole thing.
Well, sounds really yummy. And if you do send me the recipe, please make sure to tell everything that's in the solution, because many times in the solution you have many other things that are from the local environment, like herbs that do not exist somewhere else, or particular type of spices. Or
one thing I've noticed, and it's true, that fish from the Kenai River will taste fish different than fish from that you get out of the Tanana River or the Yukon River, and I understand it's because of the fat content of the northern fish. Everybody, and then you have the fish from the Kennecott or the Copper River that are the first run, and I it's been so long since I've tasted any of that fish, but I do know there is quite a bit of difference between the taste of the northern run fish and the southern run fish. And I bet if you made the same fish, or fish from different areas in the same recipe, they probably taste different.
Absolutely. I've seen that in BC, too. I mean, the different river, over the Nass River has a different taste than other ones. And, well, that could be the concept of miroir, which we're trying to develop, a little bit like the concept of terroir. Miroir. I mean, a particular environment gives a particular taste to the species that are, you know, living from it.
It only makes sense. Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
Bob, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
That's Bob from Soldotna down there on the Kenai River, where they have this legendary run of large, very fatty king salmon, huge king salmon, you know. So there's a controversy about how to not imperil those fish, because all of the Chinook salmon runs, or most of them across Alaska, are not in good shape. And it's probably from some at-sea ecosystem thing but there's not enough research money going into figuring out why or how. I'm sure you heard about this when you were in BC as well.
Well, actually, in July, they had one of the largest runs they've ever had.
Of Chinook, though?
Yes. I think it was sockeye, but I can't tell you
Fraser,
which one exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, they've been coming back up the Fraser for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, 1-800-478-8255, the telephone number. Local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. What are potential slow fish products out of Alaska? One that was brought up to me was the chums from the Arctic, which right now don't have a market. They're far away from any market. But that could be solved. I mean, you just put them on the airplane for Pete's sake. You know, I know you probably don't approve of the carbon footprint of air transportation of a fish, but that's how you get the fish fresh to another location.
Well, yeah, it depends. I mean, when you have such volumes, the local product, the local market cannot absorb it.
Yes.
So, no.
Yeah. So I guess, I've seen the abundance of the chums, and I've certainly experienced the taste of the chums up there in the Kotzebue area. And it's just a local subsistence fishery, basically, with set nets along the coast. They can come in pretty good abundance, but there's really nothing to do with them. I think there's one plant that does something, but not much. And that might be a slow fish product from
Alaska.
I've
never tried them.
Yeah. Of course you haven't.
Love to.
Yes, I'm sure you would. Michelle Mesmin is our guest from Slow Fish, part of Slow Food International. How long has Slow Food been around?
More than 20 years. 25 years with the beginning in Italy and maybe 23 for the international, beginning of the international
and there's
spreading.
Actually, there's a Slow Food college that you went to?
A university of gastronomic sciences, where you learn anything, everything about food, except how to cook the food. Not in the curricular program, at least. You learn that with the other people around, because everybody knows something about cooking, and then they teach each other.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what, your graduate school? That was your...
Yeah, I did a master's there.
Wow.
Yeah, food culture communication.
Food culture communication.
Mm-hmm.
What an odd.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's what we're doing.
Yes, that's what we're doing, exactly. That's what we're doing. These are the masters more linked into developing, let's say, local opportunities around local food, mm-hmm. including tourism, but not based on tourism alone, because if you do only tourism, then it kind of drives the soul of the place away many times, but it can be something that is part of the basket of revenues that you can get out of local food. But how to use local food also to work hand in hand with the regional identity. There's in France, for example, there's a place called Guérande, and it's a salt. It's delicious, beautiful artisanal salt, but it's also a place on the coast that, as soon as you say Guérande, everybody has a picture come to your mind. You know, that's when you know that you've made it. Because it's not only a product. It's an idea of a culture. It's an idea of a landscape. And when you manage to bind these together, you know, then usually it has survived. It survives, and it's giving local possibility to people to continue doing that production.
One thing I thought might be a possibility of an Alaska maritime product would be the various seafoods that we have that are edible, seaweeds we have that are edible.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. A big one like in Japan is the Roan kelp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they just basically build an impoundment and they put the kelp in the impoundment and herring show up and spawn all over it and that's it. Just pull those things out and sell it. It's a nice price and it goes well, but... You know, it's all edible, and there's a whole lot of edible seaweeds, and probably in Alaska we get these abundance situations, and probably nobody's even ever thought about it.
Anything from plankton to, well, seal is a little bit controversial, I guess, but here, you know, you have this tradition of seal oil, and there's a reason for it.
Yeah.
You know, and it might be an acquired taste, but it's still... A local, good, clean, and fair taste.
Right.
When
it comes to a point where it runs afoul of the law, you know, because if it's a subsistence product, then it's only customary trade can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like it's the way the law is built now. Sometimes that can get in the way, I think. You know,
laws, you mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, Subsistence is a lot of people would say was a human right. All right, so it's a kind of right, and it's protected in various ways in the law.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it becomes a commerce, then it's also something that probably should be subject to some sort of licensing or scrutiny or regulation or something like that. But if you have an absolute bar between subsistence and commerce, maybe you're impeding this sort of growth that we're talking about that's more organic and more true to the place.
Yes, I think in today's culture, if you don't do little more than subsistence, you run a very strong risk to lose that subsistence culture, unfortunately.
Over time,
and usually over a very short time. It's happening like all over Eastern Europe, for example, or Russia. Until recently, they were still like trading, or there were family recipes. But as soon as the system changes, if there's not something done to help give value to these products, well, then the industrial counterpart will just replace it.
Well, now the regulatory machinery is much more friendly towards, and we're almost getting metaphysical here, but still, is much more friendly towards that type of an industrial approach. It's easier for law and order to understand that than it is subsistence and passing things on and giving a gift for that and whatnot.
Yes, I think...
You know, it's like almost we need a different approach to regulation in a way.
Yes, that would be really nice, wouldn't it? That would be very nice. I think we've come to a time where we have to change the regulation and look at local resources in a different way, definitely, and change the development model. I mean, we cannot continue with the one we have. I mean, extractive and just overproductive, basically, logic in this world is just finishing our resources, all of them. I mean, the sea, the soil, the air. Then what?
Well,
so we need to change that, that's for sure.
I am so happy you are willing to share this discussion with us. This is just great, and I want to get back to it as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Slow Fish, an idea whose time has come in Alaska, is the subject on Talk of Alaska today. Michelle Mizman is with us of Slow Food International, straight from Italy, right here in Alaska. And Sue chimes in by email saying, hey, herring eggs on a stick is only the tiniest tip of the iceberg of native foods actively harvested, processed, and shared, with the emphasis on shared. Customary trade of native foods is very much alive and well. Check out this newer form of keep native/local food a part of daily life. And she sends me to a Facebook group that I would have to log into to get to. So we'll have to go to that. But it's the Native Food Recipes group on Facebook. Is Slow Food on Facebook?
Yes, Slow Food is on Facebook. And we also have a Slow Fish discussion group where anybody is welcome to join the discussion, which goes from tasty fish and fish traditions.
Well, when I looked
policies.
You up, Michelle, I'll have to say you're not the most frequent blogger in the world.
No, I'm not.
But you write long when you write.
Well, I'm more of a networker in a way. So I get the others to write.
So what happens if there's Alaskans, and this is probably already happening to you, that just come up to you and say, we're interested in establishing a presidium of some sort here for our, whatever it is, bidarkies. You're open to that.
I'm absolutely open to that. Anybody who writes to me, I start a conversation. Uh-huh. That's very important. As I said, it's all about relationships in the end.
Uh-huh.
And I try to restore these relationships and to understand the dynamics that are behind, just and not to have
right.
some kind of a ideology or some prejudge and get in the middle. So I can start a conversation. Then there's we can see the different things. For example, in next year, apart from, next year is Terra Madre and Salone del Gusto. Salone Gusto, as I said, was this kind of showcasing of regional product. But Terra Madre, which is in the same time, is giving voice to the producers. In 2006, we had 8,000 people from all over the world, of which I think it was 5,000 producers from fishers, breeders, everything. 1,000 cooks from all over the world, academics, youth. We're getting youth involved because they need to take this fight. Because otherwise, I mean, even if we win this battle, if we don't involve the youth, then it's going nowhere.
Battle? What's a battle? Where's the battle? What is the battle? Yeah, what are you talking about?
The battle, preserving the quality of life. That's a battle, actually. You know?
And diversity.
And diversity. Diversity of everything, of food, of characters, of knowledge, of different type of jobs.
Cultures,
yeah, languages. In 2015, we have Terra Madre Indigenous, which will be in India, where it's a large gathering of indigenous people focusing on giving value to their different cultures, for example. I would invite Alaskan people to participate
Alaska
to that.
Alaska has got to get involved in that.
Absolutely.
In India, and when? 2 years we got to plan on this?
Yes, 2 years.
All right. Well, what I'd like to have is a salmon tasting sometime where you would actually do what our last caller was talking about and actually actively have educated palates taste the different rivers. And
you know, I've thought about that, and it's so complicated because you'd have to have...
Logistically, it's a nightmare because the fish don't come up at the same time.
All the different species from the different rivers. Catch by at the sea at the beginning of the river and more towards the end of the river.
Totally. Yeah.
I mean, the Okanagan in Canada, they're doing excellent product with a fish that is already red. I mean, it's not yet decomposing, but close.
Yeah, right.
Right. So, and they gave value to it and had the people understand that that was a culture because they're very much inland. They cannot go back to the sea.
Okay, scratch that. It's never going to work. I can see it right now. Forget about it. Let's go to Eric.
No, I think it would be wonderful. I think we should work on that.
If we could find a way. But you'd have to subject everything to, you know, you have to go through a freezing process or something like that in order to really do it. So you'd have to make the active comparison and uniform. It might could be done.
It could be done.
It would take technology, but we have the technology.
Yes. And, you know, maybe you could have a salmon festival here somewhere and have people from all of the world come and learn about your salmon.
We already have salmon. We have salmon stock, you know. We already have, like, Woodstock. We got the salmon stock already in Alaska. Let's go to Sitka. And Eric joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Eric.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really enjoying the conversation with you and Michelle. Just a little background. I was born in southeast Alaska and... grew up in a, we didn't call it subsistence then, we called it living off the land, but we ate everything from clams and shrimp, and of course my dad was a commercial salmon troller. We lived on a 36-foot troller, wooden troller, and of course we harvested berries and venison and so I grew up doing that. A couple things I wanted to ask Michelle, just to clear the deck. She's not opposed to shipping food around the world. For example, those fine Italian olives, we can't get those here unless they're shipped in. There's no local olives. And on the other side of the coin, just in southeast Alaska this year, we harvested almost 100 million salmon and still... had plenty for to go up the rivers and seed the stocks. So she's not opposed to shipping products around the world when there's surpluses in one area and shortages in another, is she?
Well, slow food is born in Italy. Can you imagine an Italian giving up on coffee? Not going to happen anytime soon. and it's not produced in Italy. But I do think it's a question of proportion. I mean, it's more, I think that in every household, the local products should be privileged.
Oh, and you know, in Alaska, we have a priority. A couple things I'm not sure you're aware of. For example, we don't allow the farming of finfish in Alaska because it might affect the wild salmon populations. And I was just reading both in Norway and Scotland, and of course, right next door in Canada, we're having all kinds of problems with farmed salmon. But we don't have those problems in Alaska because we've outlawed them.
Yes, and actually, Slowfish is very much opposed to intensive salmon farms.
So when I'm thinking slow fishing and local foods, it involves a lot more than just how you prepare them. They involve how you harvest them and how you take care of the whole ecosystem involved in protecting them. So I wanted to say a couple things. You were talking about the flavors of salmon, and you were just getting started as a person who's harvested salmon with a fly rod up on practically on the spawning reds to dozens of miles offshore in the ocean. It's not only which rivers they come from, but it's what they're eating. For example, when I'm eating when I'm harvesting and eating salmon, whether they're eating krill or capelin or herring makes a big difference in the flavor of the fish that time. Also, the stage of their maturity, whether they're a young feeder or whether they're mature up the river or approaching the river, makes a great deal of difference in the flavor of the fish. And then how you handle them. When you kill them in the water like we do trolling, we catch them on hook and line, and then we actually kill them. We conk them with the gaff hook and then bleed them immediately and then dress and chill them immediately. That makes a whole difference in the flavor than if they're hanging in a net or all squished together and then jumped in a hold or something and not bled and chilled immediately.
You're talking like a troller now, I can tell you that.
Well, it does. It makes, I'm talking about the flavor of the
yeah,
fish.
Yeah, I know.
It makes
whether
a huge difference.
Fishing or stuff, all those factors make a great deal of difference in the fish. And you probably notice that in the harvesting of all kinds of things, don't you, Michelle? It's not just how you prepare them.
It's everything. I mean, we work a lot on animal breeds, and the parallel is quite, I mean, some breeds are basic rustic breeds that were genetically used to live in mountains. They live a specific herbs that are in the mountains. They have a specific build that allows them to resist to mountain conditions, you know, and they taste totally different than a breed from Normandy, for example, who just has basically flat pastures of very green grassy land. It's very different, and every breed of I don't know, goat has a different milk that gives a different cheese. I mean, it just the variation in food is infinite, and that is the beauty of it, and that is something that we believe has to be strongly promoted, because that is, in the end, it's our lives, it's our quality of life, and it's also our relationship with nature, hence with ourselves.
Just a final comment, Steve. I notice this whole thing where people want to know the story of where their products come from. Whether it's, I see on the milk cartons now, they'll tell you where you can go check out the website of the farm that this carton of milk came from. Or I was looking at some grape juice the other day, and you can go and check the farm practically where the grapes came from and the family farmers that are raising them and stuff. And I'm thinking we should do that with our fisheries in Alaska, that people could actually go online. I could tag the fish when I catch them, and they could hear the whole story of my fishing family, the health of the stock that particular fish came from. How it was processed. What do you think?
I'm working with a particular Canadian program that does exactly that. It's called This Fish.
This Yeah, I've met with this species in Canada, actually. But they're having a struggle getting it going. What's the key to making that work, Michelle? How do we tie people so that they're willing to maybe pay a little more or do a little research so they can find out this information? How does that get developed?
This fish, you mean?
Or anything of that nature. To expand it, because a lot of this is about, it's about educating the consumer.
Yes.
But you've got, that assumes the consumer wants to be educated. And, I mean, you know, people go to the cheapest place sometimes just because that's all they can afford.
Well, yeah, but this kind of tool kind of addresses a different type of clients, which is, and we're having more and more and more of these people that, yes, they want the story with it because it gives meanings to their own lives. You know, and people are searching for meaning. I mean, sometimes you're running around one job and the TV and the kids and then your mortgage loan.
So to answer Eric's question, maybe the reason that it's a struggle, this fish is a struggle, is because it's new.
Yeah, I think it's new and it's less and less of a struggle because they've been developing with more and more fisheries. So, like, the problems are getting solved here and there. We're working with fisheries in Mexico now to get their spiny lobsters on board. We've been working with fishermen in Holland, right, working on that program. And they're very satisfied for now. And because it is an NGO, well, you're not paying the actual cost for it. I mean, for like, it's not a profit. They don't do it out of profit. So first you work on it. And when you see that there's value added to your fish, then you pay a minimal surplus, which I think it's something like 0.03 cents or something. It really depends on the fishery, too. But the main thing with this fish is it's first of all, it was a tool that was asked for by fishermen. They went to EcoTrust Canada and asked them, can we have this tool? Can you work on it? EcoTrust found the funds to develop it as a tool and is constantly working on it to make it better, to make it more friendly for the fishermen, and to get basically more features into it. So now a consumer gets the code when he buys the fish or at the restaurant or at the store. And he can see everything, the pictures of the fishing family, the biology of the fish, the like little infographics on the fishing techniques, the tasting notes, the better recipes to do
Whoa.
It, you, the logbook. He can write to the fisherman directly and say, hey, I loved your fish.
Eric, that's one of the best answers to a question from a listener I ever got.
This fish has an amazing website. If Affordable Care Hack had that good of a website, we wouldn't have any problems with it. Yeah, it's amazing, the stuff that's available now, so people can actually see pictures of the fishermen. They can read about the history of the fishery. I want to talk one thing about subsistence.
Okay, Eric, we're running low on time here, so we got a stack of callers.
Sharing with the harvest, the stories are a big part of the whole picture on eating off the land. So I'll let you go. Bye.
All right. Thanks a lot, Eric, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Okay, here's one. This is slow food. This is not actually slow fish. This is on land. It's in the tundra. But if you know how to tap your feet on the tundra, you can find where the little mice go. And they grab the tubers from underneath the plants and make these stashes. And if you know where to go, the mouse has already gathered all your food for you.
Wow.
Don't you want to taste that?
I would love to taste that.
Let's go to Gus Davis. And Judy joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Judy.
Hi. Yeah, I want to bring up a problem and question that I've been thinking about, and I don't have a good answer, but there's a conflict between local food and, I'm afraid, the charter fisheries. because the charter fisheries, most especially, you know, have day trips, and they operate out of communities, and they operate in nearby areas more than commercial fishing does. And they can, the result can be quite a depletion of fish available locally to people who live in those communities. And, you know, subsistence and personal use fishing, that's nice, but it's irrelevant if the resources aren't there, or they're only available at a great distance, an impractical distance. And we have, in these communities, coastal communities, we have a lot of families and others trying to live there because they like it, they want to live there, but the jobs are very little, few, in especially they're very seasonal. So providing your own food is part of the pleasure and economic feasibility of living there. And of course there's other things besides fish. There's game. Some areas you can do gardening, but a lot of our communities are in bad areas for that. And gathering, there's wild other resources to gather besides fish. But this is a problem, and I do have a fair background in fisheries management knowledge, so of how Alaska's fisheries are managed. But I still have not seen the fine solution to this. I do realize, by
so
the way,
they, that what you're talking about, growing competition of the charter fleet with the commercial fleet.
No.
What problem is that?
That competition has been talked about a lot, or
right.
That conflict. What I'm talking about is people who live in coastal communities trying to fish for their own food, but the charter fleet, just because it, you know, they have day trips, they're located
right.
Where they can...
I got it. Yeah, let's ask Michelle about that, because that's got to be happening all over the Mediterranean.
So are we talking about recreational fisheries here?
It's a recreational fishery, but you have a local indigenous fishery, and then you have some rich client that wants to go out, and they end up getting the fish because they got better gear and whatever.
Well, that's a tough one, but I think, what we're trying to focus is on resilient coastal communities. So
right.
That means that the community themselves have to take the decisions that allow for their best survival and better development, let's say. So,
yeah, but how do you do the question she's got is, how could you possibly organize and defend if the charter is actually starting to eat into your own consumption?
Well, the charter owners, I suppose, are from that community, right?
Not necessarily, right, Judy?
In our town, there's a lot of charter operators. One of them lives here, and both the clients and the operators are all from down south.
Yeah.
From out of state. And I know that in South Central, especially like in Cook Inlet, quite a bit of the clients actually are Alaska people, and maybe quite a few of the operators too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we got so far, is that if they're part of the community, then they can be, because they are part of the community.
Then the community needs to gather and decide, you know, how
yeah.
they're going to do it. Because if it's a public resource,
I think the priority is
for people who live there to gather that food.
In a way, yeah, I see. If they are in the community, in other words, your charter operators are local, then there's some potential for keeping the resilience just through community processes. But if they're not, if in other words, you have charter quotas, which they are trying to do,
mm-hmm.
then quota share becomes something that's sold.
That's
and
a
then you're
going to
have absentee owners. And evidently that's kind of what's happened there in the Glacier Bay area. Very interesting. Judy, I want to get to some other calls.
Steve, but there's not, you're wrong. There's that quota share thing is not happening. That was abandoned long ago. There's,
yeah.
there's a kind of limited entry now in charters.
Right. Yeah, they don't dare. I know. Yeah,
but I think the community should try to protect what is their grounds, their fishing grounds. So I mean, if charters is actually giving some development opportunities to the community, then the community must choose which activity they're going to privilege. Nobody can tell that to them or force them to either drive the charters out or or have more charges. I think that's I think that's something that the community itself needs to resolve.
Wait. Fisheries management is in Alaska is not done by communities. In fact, halibut is federally done by a federal committee and council, and there's a statewide council, but communities do not really have much of an option to be involved.
There's no legal, let's say, possibility to get, if the community decides that the charter are impeding their right to feed themselves, do you think there's no legal way to actually prohibit these charters to come into their, into the waters?
No, of course, you've got that far.
That's what I've been trying to figure out.
Huh.
At one point in the 90s, Sitka managed to do a local area management plan for Sitka Sound.
Right.
But it's pretty well agreed that that's a one-off and it can't be done anymore. But and it was for exactly that reason. The local people couldn't catch a halibut, for instance, in a day's skiff ride from Sitka anymore.
I've heard of stories where they're doing it right now in Canada, at least. I mean, but that was a very long battle, and they won in court and got some of their territory back and then the right to manage it.
It's about as far as we can take this one, Judy.
Okay.
Yeah, but thanks so much for your
Yes,
your
it's
call.
A very interesting question. Sorry, yeah. We cannot go more in depth
Indeed.
In this particular.
Indeed. Well, that's a sign of a good show. Several calls came in about radiation and concerns about radiation in fish. Are you concerned about radiation in fish?
I'm concerned about toxicity in our world in general, and not only in fish, in everything we eat, everything we wear, every product we use. So radiation is just one more.
Yeah. And this one from Cindy, kind of a pat on the back, says, wonderful guest, so broad-ranging, so insightful. She's giving excellent answers, such a great resource. Cindy in Southeast, sharing the stories, busy spreading the word of the importance of local art and craft, and the Alaska gift and souvenir market, it all comes to the same point. Harvest locally, local value added. Visitors want the local connection. And
absolutely.
They do. We got the internet now. For Pete's sake. What we need is imagination, creativity, and grit.
Yes, yes. We have grit. To think. We cannot think. It's not going back to the past where everything was much more isolated. I think we have new communication ways to get out of this isolation and be more creative.
Michelle Mazzat, Miss Matt, I look forward to your next visit to Talk of Alaska.
Well, so do I.
All right. Thank you so much. Next week, the special two-hour statewide holiday greeting show. Remember, we got like Russian Christmas solstice, all kinds of things. Hanukkah.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.